Very good morning to everyone. Our first case on this morning's call is number 042015, the United States against Cedric Washington. Ms. Johnson.
Good morning. My name is Tiffany Johnson, and I'm appearing on behalf of Mr. Cedric Washington. A two-day trial is too short of a time to not have been infected by the problematic questioning of the judge in this case and by a prosecutor who was a bit too carried away with the argument to stay within the boundaries of zealous advocacy. In the case at hand, the judge took it upon himself to question a witness during a time period where there were no issues that needed clarification, and there was nothing confusing about the questions that were being presented during cross-examination. The judge questioned the witness about the meaning of her oath, an area that was not explored by either side. I would suggest to you that such questioning was inappropriate, was not to clarify any issues or to otherwise make the trial go more smoothly, but was in fact simply to, in a sense, rehabilitate the witness.
But Ms. Johnson, isn't this essentially a fairly collateral matter? It doesn't really go to the substance of what she was saying. It simply, as you said, talks about the oath, and then he dropped it after she answered the question.
I would agree that it is somewhat of a collateral matter, except to the extent that the jurors were going to have to make a determination about the credibility of her testimony. And that actually goes to the heart of the very trial itself, judging the credibility of witness testimony. And I would suggest that when judges start questioning witnesses about the meaning of their oath and do it in the manner in which it was done in this case, that that is very problematic. I would suggest that it conveys to jurors somewhat of a benevolence, and the very manner in which the questions were posed were actually suggesting the answer to the witness.
But you were trial counsel, right?
Yes.
You had an opportunity to impeach this witness, didn't you?
Yes, and in fact, I was in the middle of attempting that impeachment, and I do believe that in certain areas I was able to impeach her, specifically about the benefits that she was hoping to receive from her testimony from officers.
Could it have been that the judge actually agreed with you and was simply warning the witness that she shouldn't perjure herself and warning the government that they shouldn't suborn perjury? Is that a possible interpretation of that exchange?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the wording that was used suggested that, and if in fact the judge was attempting to suggest it, I believe that his wording should have been much clearer. I would suggest that in fact when the judge said, "And you're not concerned about anything but telling the truth," that's a question that suggests the answer, and it suggests the judge's perception.
Depends on tone and inflection, it would seem to me, too.
Well, I would argue that if the judge had asked an open-ended question, it would be different. But the closed question, witness, you're not concerned about anything but telling the truth.
Are you
is
giving
closed.
The same inflection?
I am giving an inflection, yes, Your Honor.
Well, I say the same inflection that he gave.
I would be hesitant to try to repeat to try to argue that I'm repeating his inflection.
Well, as Judge Ripple just pointed out, however, that there are different tonal inflections that mean different things when you're asking a question.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So if I went back and listened, was there a tape recording of this?
There's no, Your Honor, there's no tape recording.
Pity.
I would suggest, however, that the very wording of that question suggests the answer, which is yes. I don't believe that there would be a witness who could possibly or would possibly answer no to that question about whether you're concerned and you're not concerned about anything but telling the truth.
Could I ask you this? I recall that there was another witness, though, that the judge brought out the fact that there was an exchange of money, a payment. Wasn't the judge just trying to make sure that all the relevant facts were out?
I would suggest that in questioning a witness about her oath, that is not an area where the judge should have properly attempted to make certain that there was a relevant fact that was missing. I would suggest that that questioning, as well as the questioning about the individual's military service, once again conveyed a very benevolent tone to members of the jury that surpassed simply clarifying and making sure that all of the issues were in fact presented to the jury.
Although you have to admit, I mean, the witness's answer when he says he learned to lie and deceive while he was in the military is somewhat odd.
It was odd, and actually I was quite ready, quite prepared to go into detail and depth about how being in the military taught this witness to lie and deceive. Instead, the judge interrupted and took the questioning in a direction that was completely not I would suggest completely not appropriate. There weren't any questions before the witness about what branch of the military he was in, how long he was in the military or when he was in the military, whether he had been honorably discharged. These areas weren't part of the issues before the jury.
Were you precluded from going back to the topic of why he learn to lie and deceive there, or did you at that point decide that it was not relevant?
I was not precluded from returning to that topic, and I do believe that I was able to continue my impeachment of the witness. However, I would suggest that when the judge began to ask this line of questioning, the damage was done in that it conveyed a sense of benevolence, a sense of positivity towards the witness to the jurors. But the
judge then instructs the jurors at the end that anything he said and other counsel isn't evidence. And as you've said with respect to both of these witnesses, you were able to present impeaching evidence to the jury, and we assume juries pay attention to all of these things. So even if the judge crossed the line somehow, wouldn't any such error be harmless under all the circumstances?
If the trial were longer, then probably. However, in a two-day trial where you have this type of conveyed benevolence, certainly a demeanor or a benevolence that the jury could have found to be present, combined with the other error that I have cited in the brief regarding the prosecutor's overzealousness, which occurred on the second day. The judge's questioning occurred on the first day. The combination of both of those methods of proceeding is what has made this an unfair trial to Mr. Washington. Mr. Bass is an advocate, and unfortunately, in this particular case, I would suggest he went a little too far. I would suggest that he crossed the boundaries in his rebuttal argument when he characterized, when he painted a picture that defense counsel, as opposed to simply the defense, was problematic, was that defense counsel was misrepresenting the evidence. I would suggest when you have both of these actions by the presiding judge and by the prosecutor, that is what made this an unfair trial to Mr. Washington. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. We'll hear now from Mr. Bass.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Timothy Bass. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney, and I represent the United States, and I was also trial counsel for the government below. Your Honors, if I may, I'll address the prosecutorial misconduct argument first. And I would submit to Your Honors that the defendant in this case is essentially asking this court to license his giving of false testimony and misrepresentation of evidence to the jury, while at the same time issuing a sanction to the government and declaring as prosecutorial misconduct, or in this case, plain error, the government's pointing out to the jury that false testimony or misrepresentations.
But there are some things that you were complaining about that seem to me well within the boundaries of fair debate. For example, where you say the representation that Darrell Washington was being paid $1,000, absolutely false, he was being paid $200. Well, it depended. There was evidence about $1,000 or more overall. There was evidence about $290. It really depended on what one's focus was, and it seems to me to label that a blatant falsehood, absolutely false, is itself a stretch. The number 1,000 was certainly there.
Your Honor, on that point, of all the arguments that were made, I agree with you that if you look at that one argument in isolation, that there is at least the potential that the evidence could be viewed in different ways. But I would simply say to you that the argument that was made at the time by defense counsel was prospective. If you go back and look at the transcript, defense counsel argued that the government, that Mr. Washington, Darrell Washington, the informant, the police officers were targeting the defendant, and he was being paid over $1,000. That is an argument that is using an active voice, not looking in retrospect. And my argument stating that that was false was that it was suggesting to the jury that Mr. Washington, the informant, was being paid the total amount of money that he was being paid for all of the cases, and lumping all that money together and saying he was being paid in this case over $1,000 to target the defendant. And that suggestion was false, Your Honor.
That may be true, but I think you're parsing it much more finely than the evidence would have supported, since somebody who's, let's say, in the business of being an informant for the government may very well take into account his general business, not just, you know, the $200 or so for a particular case. I mean, I was just disturbed by the overall tone, even if some of the things you complained about, let's say you had a stronger basis of complaint for, and I think that's clearly true. I don't know where this speculation that the videos weren't in real time came from, since, as I understand it, there's a time stamp on the video, or at least that's what I understood from your brief. So you know, if you go point to point to point, I think we come up with a spectrum where some of them seem to me certainly fair argument, others of them seem to me, you know, I don't really know where they came from. But when you're sort of throwing these very inflammatory words around, it makes it less professional, if you will.
Your Honor, I would simply say to you that I understand that a judge, reviewing judge, looking at this record a year and a half after the fact and looking at particular words that have been lumped together and bold-faced in a brief might give pause to the use of those words. But I would simply ask you to view the argument that was given in context. And if you go back and look at the record and view the argument in context, which the Supreme Court instructs us to do, you'll find that what I was attempting to do was not disparage defense counsel. In fact, I think the defense counsel concedes in the brief that there was no direct attempt to do that, but in a reply brief now attempts to suggest that that was the implication. But in any event, the context was that I was responding to specific arguments. And this court has said repeatedly that characterization of a defense as fabricated is no more improper than calling the defendant a liar, and that is perfectly proper, in fact, advisable, as this court said in Reed, to respond to misleading arguments. And that was the sole intent that I was trying to develop, point by point. For example, Your Honor, the defendant testified that despite the video recording evidence, that it was not he who distributed crack cocaine to the informant on the first by April 9th. Despite the fact that the video itself showed the defendant in possession of crack cocaine and showed him in possession of money after he met with the informant, the defendant testified that it was not he who distributed the crack, but this person named Michi who pulled it out of his mouth. And defense counsel repeated that representation during closing argument. Similarly, as with respect to count two, the defendant testified that rather than him distributing crack to the informant, it was the informant who distributed crack to the defendant, despite the fact that the defendant himself admitted on cross-examination that he was the one in possession of money, and there was no exchange between the informant and anyone else. Now, I would suggest to you, Your Honor, and it was certainly my intent at the time, to simply say that the defendant's testimony and his counsel's argument based on that testimony were false, or with respect to those two arguments, that the defense was, quote, made up. Now, certainly I could have used less forceful terms, but that is not the issue before the court today. The issue before the court today is whether what I said was prosecutorial misconduct impugning the integrity of defense counsel, or, since there was no objection, plain error. And if you look at the argument in context, what I said was certainly no more, and I would argue less inflammatory, than referring to the defendant as a liar or characterizing the defense as fabricated. And the court need not rely on my representation here today, Your Honors. I would encourage you to review the video, or at the very least, refer to what the district court found, which was not even referenced in the defendant's opening brief. The district court looked at the transcripts after the trial, and it concluded that the government's argument was appropriate and went further and said that that defense counsel argued, quote, a very creative version of the facts which had little support in the evidence. I would submit, Your Honor, that's the functional equivalent, maybe more kind, but certainly the functional equivalent of what I was essentially arguing to the jury. And again, Your Honors, most importantly, my argument was an attack on defense counsel's arguments and not her personally. And under that context, even if forceful, was not prosecutorial misconduct and certainly was not plain error.
You did say at one point the representation to you that was made by Ms. Johnson twice that said that Daryl Washington said that's when I was handing him the crack cocaine, that's patently false. But I mean, I certainly take your point as an overall view, but I think maybe the thing that has inspired this argument here were the personal references to her.
There was one instance where I said, referring to the representation, but attributing it to Ms. Johnson, there was one instance where I did that. But again, if you look at the entire rebuttal argument, focus, I would submit, is clearly on the argument, the representation both by the defendant and then repeated by his attorney. And I would point out, Your Honor, to this court's decision in Reed, which is cited in the brief, and this court's decision in Dada, which Judge Bauer participated in, where this court essentially faced the same argument and said that although defense counsel suggests that the prosecutor accused defense counsel of lying or misrepresenting the evidence 12 times during his rebuttal, we find that he was merely attempting to rebut the picture of innocence portrayed by defense counsel during closing argument. Same is true here. Your Honors, with respect to the first argument challenging the district court's questions, conceding the fact that for purposes of argument today, that Judge McCuskey's, some of his questions, and keeping in mind there were other questions that are not challenged, such as the ones you referenced, Your Honor, asking about how much an informant was paid.
Yeah.
But conceding the isolated questions that are challenged, such as whether Ms. Fullerton understood the meaning of an oath, that such questions may have been unnecessary. That does not mean that those questions conveyed a bias by the district court concerning the guilt of the defendant, or more importantly, established serious prejudice. If you look at the colloquy that we had with Judge McCuskey when the jury, outside the presence of the jury, when Ms. Johnson made these objections, which the rule allowed her to do, you'll find nowhere in there where there was any request for a remedy. I mean, there was no request for a mistrial. So is the argument today that it was per se reversible error at the time and the judge should have sua sponte declared a mistrial? That certainly wasn't the argument at trial. There was no request for a curative instruction. There was simply a conveyance of an objection, and Judge McCuskey disagreed. And this court may find that his questions were unnecessary, but then what? Again, there's no argument here today that his questions were per se reversible error. And he did issue a curative instruction at the end of the trial. And he simply said that nothing that he did was meant to convey a belief on his part about what the jury's verdict should be. That's what this court said in Martin, quote, removed any potential for prejudice. So, Your Honors, I would submit to you that the questions were not improper, but even if unnecessary, certainly did not convey or establish serious prejudice to the defendant so as to require reversible error. Your Honors,
do you agree that we should do a Palladino remand on sentence? There are quite a few enhancements, and you argued that the main thing was the career criminal point, which established the levels, but nonetheless it was done as though it was mandatory.
Your Honor, there is not, after rereading U.S. versus Lee, which I believe in there, the companion case to Palladino, Judge Easterbrook lists some possible examples where it would not be plain error or would not be in the need to issue a limited remand. But this court in Palladino rejected the government's argument that a mere sentence above the minimum of the guideline range was enough. There are statements in there by Judge McCuskey about the defendant's criminal history and that he could not justify under any circumstances, imposing a sentence at the minimum. I'm not sure that is sufficient to satisfy Palladino and Lee. And if Your Honors agree, then certainly the limited remand would be appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The statement from the district court that Mr. Bass cited was issued in a ruling prior to the district court having a full transcript. Both Mr. Bass and I ordered portions of the transcript, but the district court did not have the full transcript. So the district court did not have the benefit of actually comparing my arguments to the evidence at the time that it issued. It made that statement in its ruling, and I would suggest that during a briefing of this issue, I was able to substantiate most, if not all, of my arguments. The weakest argument, I definitely would admit, was the video argument. However, the rest of the arguments that I made did have a basis in the evidence, and the argument that I made regarding the videotape, I just requested that the jury look at the videotape again and make up their own minds regarding that particular issue. And since the videotape was in evidence, it was my suggestion that, in fact, that was something they could do. And in referencing Mr. Bass's arguments where I disagreed with his characterization of the evidence, I was very clear in making sure that the jury recognized that I was disagreeing with his characterization, but I wasn't calling him, I wasn't saying that he misrepresented the evidence, that he created, made up things where they didn't exist. And there's a fine line, there's a big line between those two different types of arguments. One completely puts defense counsel in a place where the jury could believe that defense counsel was trying to trick them, that defense counsel created stuff or evidence that wasn't there. That's a very different position from a scenario where a defendant takes the stand, puts forth his version of the facts, and counsel argues that that version of the facts is incorrect. It's, you're not in a situation where you're arguing that the attorney misrepresented evidence. You're in a situation where you're saying the defendant's defense simply is not to be believed, that my case is stronger and that my case stands on its own. And that, I would suggest to you, is the proper way to put forth a rebuttal argument, not a scenario where you're attacking defense counsel as having made up evidence or having misrepresented the evidence that was put before the jury. There were two different sides, as there is in every trial, and that's the way that it should have been argued. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Indeed, our thanks to both Ms. Johnson and to Mr. Bass for the